I have the privilege today of speaking with Brantley Vossler. And Brantley has been a participant in a couple of places on the corner so far. And I'm interested in hearing Brantley's story and getting to know you a little bit better. And so I'm just going to let you take it away, introduce yourself, and then tell us what you want to talk about.
Well, Karen, thank you so much. This is such a delight. I've seen a number of your conversations, and yeah, I feel, new-ish to this so-called this little corner. And people may have just seen me one time talking with Christian Baxter and Drew Psychology as he goes by. So that's kind of really the only outside of just, Twitter comments and things like that. But in your world, that's really the only places I've really participated in. But it's really such a delight to just meet all these folks. Isn't it just it's just so wonderful what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, it truly is. And I've had the privilege of talking to a lot of people because I do one or two episodes a week and have done for like 5 years. So
Wow.
I've met a lot of different people and I love every one of them. And then when I go to a conference and then get to meet them in person, it's really magical. So yeah.
Yeah. Oh man, that must just be so wonderful. I am a worship pastor up in Ann Arbor, Michigan at Grace Bible Church, and I'm a dad of two young kids. And so definitely with those two things, that's enough to keep me busy. And I, Twitter and those types of things, I probably need to even do better at keeping them in the corners of my life, because there's lots going on at the church, and taking care of young kids is keeping me busy. But I'm also just I was telling Annie Crawford this one time, which by the way, I just loved your that's one of the ones I watched, your conversation with Annie, and that was a particularly delightful one. But I was telling her, that I view myself very much as a learner from a lot of folks in this little corner. I feel young in exploring some of these themes and ideas, and there's so many, it seems like there's so many people to learn from. That's kind of, I guess, how I see myself fitting, as like a student. I have a lot of questions. But yeah, some of the themes that I would love to discuss. I mean, I'm always interested in particular with my job, being a worship pastor. I'm interested in church music, and so I brushed up on your conversation with Drew. That was even a few years ago now. And then yeah, the other one too, I would be curious in hearing your thoughts on, is the topic of deconstruction, people leaving faith, and then just why that is. Why is that happening? What are the particular circumstances that are leading to that in our culture? So yeah, those are a few of the topics I'd love to pick your brain on a little bit.
Well, okay, but before we get there, I'm going to pick your brain a little bit.
Yeah, sounds
But
good.
you're a worship pastor. How did you get started doing that? And did it have anything to do with the way you grew up? I mean, could you back up a little bit and talk about how you grew up and then how you ended up doing what you do now?
Yeah, so I actually did music for my youth group at a very young age. It was a wonderful thing about our youth group culture. They let students serve, and that had pluses and minuses. In some ways, we just had no idea what we were doing or what we were getting into. But yeah, I started doing that at a young age. I think I got my first guitar around 15, and I was up there at around 16, and so I started doing that. That was when I would say, that was the worship wars in Protestant culture, evangelical culture. I feel like that's a pretty this was around the year 2000, that definitely the worship wars are still, I mean, they're still kind of going on today, but then it was, my church had a contemporary service and a traditional service. And so we were getting along that way, kind of, if you can call that getting along. But yeah, I was That's where I was kind of thrown in way back when. I'm 37 now, so that was now about 20 years ago. And then yeah, I pretty much walked away from faith through college. I kind of did a I was in a band, and we were making kind of semi-Christian music, you might call it, and at least music with Christian themes. But a lot of the people I was listening to, even Christians, were kind of on their way out of faith, and that was very much me as well.
So could you name some of those bands?
Yeah, you know, one of the ones I was that just popped in my mind, David Bazan and Pedro the Lion. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. He has a project, he has a project called Pedro the Lion. So that's kind of the same person, but he goes by his name and that other band. And there was one album of his. So he also grew up in evangelical culture and made kind of alt rock music, just to give a little bit of context. And he had an album that was pretty central to a lot of discussions my friends and I were having, where he was really like, it was kind of like his I'm leaving the faith, at least the faith as I know it, album. And so, you know, I spent, I don't know, I that one record, I probably talked to, I don't know, 100 hours about the themes in that album. It was very that one really seemed to strike a chord. And then it was kind of like, well, which way are we going to go? Are we going to follow him kind of out? And so I was very much caught in between, but I did pretty much choose to leave, stopped going to church, and just had a lot of big questions and a lot of frustrations that were, yeah, unresolved for a long time. So anyways, I feel like I'm rambling a little bit. I was then hired. I'm summing up so many years here, as it's always hard to do. But essentially what happened was I met a guy who discipled young men. And he was familiar with this story, with this pattern of deconstruction, of leaving the faith, of particular frustrations that I had. And so he had answers to a lot of them. And he used to be a pastor, but he just started a nonprofit discipling young men in Chicago. That's where I was living at the time. And so that really, really helped me. I mean, frankly, he just loved me in a very difficult time of life. And that made such a big difference. And so I ended up being, I was making music the whole time, and I ended up being hired to work back actually at my youth group that I grew up in. And so sometimes I wonder if they should have hired me. I was so recently upset at that church and even at that culture, and God really did, he healed me in many ways, but they trusted me to be a leader, and I was so thankful for that time, because I really learned that a lot of my frustrations were projections of myself, you might say. And as I kind of sought to be humble in that space and learn from them, rather than me thinking I was a know-it-all, a young 20s know-it-all, that was so deeply healing for me. And so I worked there, and then my church in Ann Arbor is semi-connected with them. And so yeah, now I've been at my church here for 10 years. So yeah, how was that that was a pretty quick flyby. I feel like I did.
So
okay.
I'm a little curious about your church in Ann Arbor, because I attended a church in Ann Arbor one time that was very instrumental in my life.
Really?
And I wonder if possibly it might be the same church.
Oh, but okay.
It was at the time I was there, that was 1990.
Okay.
And it was meeting in a gymnasium. Do you know anything about the history of your church?
I know enough about that we wouldn't have been meeting in a gymnasium in 1990.
Okay.
So our building that I'm in now is on the west side of Ann Arbor, and it was built in the 70s.
Okay.
They had bought a church downtown Ann Arbor that was that you probably so did you how long did you spend in Ann Arbor?
Well, I was just there visiting a friend.
Oh, okay.
I think I had been there twice visiting her, but this one particular time, it came after a time of really severe trauma in my life. And we went to visit that church. The most remarkable thing happened because, and I've told this story recently, so some people might have already heard it. They can just tune out. But anyway, this little church is meeting in a gymnasium. I don't think anybody knows about this church, very small congregation. And this lady walked up to me and she said, "Karen." And I said, "Do I know you?" She said, "Yes." And I had met her. So this was 1990. I had met her in 1985 at a missionary internship program in Detroit, Michigan, where she was serving, helping to train missionaries who were going out into unreached peoples on how to work with people who've never heard the gospel, and also helping people with how to be solid and how to find a way to be strengthened in your faith, even if you can't be attending worship services every week. And, you know, how do you navigate this when you're all alone out there someplace? And so I had met her at that thing. And then I remembered, oh, yeah, she wasn't a particular part of my program, but I had seen her at this place. And anyway, she walks up to me and she says, you know, tells me who she is. And then she says, "You look like you need a hug." And I said, "Oh, I'm fine, really. But, you know, I'm always willing to hug somebody." So she gave me a hug. The minute she hugged me, I just fell apart. I just completely fell apart. And she said, "You need to come and see me tomorrow." Mm. Now, she still lived in Detroit. And what on earth she was doing at that church on that day, I have no idea, because that was the only day I was ever at that church.
Wow.
And when I went to see her the next day, she told the most remarkable story. She and her husband had been missionaries in some remote village someplace for 25 years. I can't remember if it was South America or Africa, but she had had children on this mission field and had had some postpartum depression. And during this depression, that was during a time when people didn't talk about depression in the church, was forbidden, you know, and you certainly didn't seek help for it, because it probably meant that you just weren't praying hard enough or you weren't faithful enough. And her husband just kept keeping on with the ministry, and she's supposed to be taking care of the children and handling things. And she just went further and further and further down the hole and wasn't finding any help anywhere. She went through 25 years of this, and she was completely worn out and angry and depressed. And she was back in the United States on a kind of a deputation year. And went to a women's group of some kind. And there was a nun at this women's group. And the nun looked at her and said, "I think you need a hug." And so that nun said, "I would like to listen to you, because I can tell there are things you need to talk about that you've never had an opportunity to talk about." And that nun sat and listened to her for an entire day, just mirroring her emotions and listening to her and letting her pour out all of this suffering and struggle that she'd been through. And then she realized she needed to start getting some help for all these things that she'd been holding in. And she went through a deep healing process in that. And she determined that from then on, if she ran into people who needed someone to listen to them, she would be that listener.
Yeah, wow.
So she said, "I'm here today to listen to you."
Wow.
And I'm like, I'm fine.
Yeah.
But once I started talking, it just started pouring out. I talked for 5 hours nonstop.
Yeah.
To have somebody who would actually listen to all the fears and anxieties and inability to understand some of the things that had happened to me and why I had the thoughts and feelings that I had during that process, and, you know, thinking I was a bad person because I was having those thoughts, and just all of that just came pouring out. And she was so faithful to listen to me.
Wow.
It was a remarkable experience. But if I had not been at that place at that time, and if she had not been at that place at that time, I would have never.
Yeah.
You know, so I always thought that little church in Ann Arbor, Michigan, meeting in that gymnasium was.
Wow. Praise God for them in that, in that moment. Yeah. It's something, you know, when I was talking about that, the gentleman in Chicago who discipled me, I mean, I had a, really almost a borderline embarrassing experience. He actually later wrote about it in his book. It's funny, he changed my name, in the book because it's, anyway, so I was in a similar spot, you know, this deep, dark spot. And I was invited to this dinner at his house. Some Christians were just having dinner, and, you know, no one said, would you like a hug? But at the end of dinner, they just said, we're going to take prayer requests. And I thought, uh-oh, I have some, and they're big, and I don't know any of these people, but I knew that I just somehow knew that I could trust them. And, I could, you know, you could tell that they loved each other. And so here I am at this dinner table full of strangers, and they had a plan for the evening. I don't know if they were going to play a board game or if they were going to, I don't know what their plan was, but the plan, once I opened my mouth, was basically over. Because I was a puddle of tears and was just, you know, and I was just kind of saying it all, everything that was going on. And that really began, someone listening to me, but someone wise that was listening to me. I had friends to listen to me grumble, without wisdom. And that, was not really that helpful, honestly. I needed someone with wisdom, someone who was listening with the Holy Spirit to correct me where I was wrong and say, actually, you're really onto something here, when I was when I was right. And so, but man, it seems we can't control those moments of when something, like when the Lord is going to use an instrument of his to, you know, I wish we could have it in a nice controlled space, but we can't. Sometimes it's just like, oh, someone gave me a hug and here I am. Mm-hmm. But yeah, praise God that he's working even with long times of pain. He's still healing.
Well, so let's dive back into your story a little bit. You said you were in college. What were you studying in college?
Yeah. So I, at that time in Chicago, I was studying audio, at Columbia College in Chicago. So, that's my only degree. I have a bachelor's in audio engineering. And so I was really studying to record, music. Some of my professors had recorded Michael Jackson and different people in Chicago. And so that's kind of the track that I thought I was going to go on, recording bands and music. And I tell a funny story about my mom. If she ever watches this, maybe she would get a kick out of this, but she she said, oh, you should move to LA and do music. And she's from Detroit. And so I was like, Mom, you want me to move to LA? That's so far away. But yeah, that was really the plan. I was going to kind of live that type of life. And so that's what I was studying at the time, audio. Mm-hmm. That's why even microphones like this are lying around, and I can still use them from time to time. So,
mm-hmm. And then you met this gentleman from the nonprofit organization. Is that nonprofit organization still functional?
Yeah. It's called Icon Ministries, I believe. I mean, it's very, in some ways it's very informal. He runs it himself. There's a few other people that run it with him.
Is there a reason that it's called Icon Ministries?
You know, I don't ever remember talking to him about that,
Wow,
honestly, but
that's so
I'm sure there
interesting.
is. Yeah, it is very interesting.
I did several episodes early on the difference between an icon and an idol.
Oh man,
And
I
it's
need to watch
really
those. That's
a
a
deep
very
dive.
important,
Yeah, very
yeah,
deep
it's a
dive.
very important conversation today.
Yeah.
Yeah, you would certainly love talking to my friend Louis. He is brilliant, and yeah, I wish we could bring him on here and ask him.
So, you do worship music at your church. What kind of music do you do?
So, we do sometimes, I guess, what I might call blended. You've probably heard that term. So yeah, we don't separate, we don't separate our, contemporary and traditional, music, but we do both. We do a good amount of, hymns and modern music. I saw that you were at the Sing conference
Oh yeah,
recently.
that was fantastic experience.
Yeah, was that a first time going there, or had you been to
Yes.
other ones?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the reason that I went is very, I think, a very interesting story, because I have a daughter who is well, I won't give away her age, but she's my oldest daughter.
Okay.
And I'm 76, so you can kind of guess what her age
Okay.
range is. And she had walked away from the Lord for about 15 years. And then a year ago, through a very unique circumstance, she found herself in a church. Now, she didn't go to the church because she wanted to go to church. She went to the church because she had been studying calligraphy. And she was looking for someone who was using calligraphy in a kind of service oriented position, like maybe doing free murals for people, or so you could do this as a service to other people, go out and do free calligraphy. And so she had asked around, and her calligraphy teacher said, well, I don't know anybody who's actually doing that, you know, as a service thing, but I do know this one woman who does calligraphy and paints murals, and she's a pastor's wife. So my daughter got the information from her, the contact information, but all she had was the address of the church. So in order to get this woman's contact, she had to go to the church and sit through a church service.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
And very interesting church. The pastor had been a drug runner and was in the middle of a drug deal where he was the one who delivered the drugs, and the guy who was receiving them didn't want to pay the money. And so he was just going to kill the drug runner and take the drugs. So he had a gun at Fuego's head. And all that Fuego could think to do, he knew he was going to die. All he could think to do is remember back that for many years, his mother had put a verse on his bed every night when he'd come home from all these things. And the verse she put on his bed was, there is a way that seems right unto a man, but the end
Whoa.
thereof is death.
Whoa.
And that verse came back to him.
Oh my word.
And so when the gun is at his head, he just said, Jesus.
My word.
And the killer looks at him and says, stop saying that. So he said it again. Stop saying that. And he just started backing up. And he said, get
Oh,
out
my
of here.
word.
And so Fuego
Wow.
took off, got in the car and drove away. But now he doesn't have the drugs and he doesn't have the money. And he knows that the guy who sent him there with the drugs is going to come looking for him. So he figures, I'm going to have to go and talk to that guy one way or another. So I'm just going to get it over with now. So he went, he told the guy the whole story, just the way it happened.
Wow.
He thought, I have nothing to lose. They're going to kill me anyway. And the guy said, look, I don't know what to make of that, but you just get out of here and leave me alone.
Oh my goodness. And is this the pastor you said?
This is the pastor of this little church.
Okay.
So she hears this story. He tells the story one way or another almost every Sunday because he's ministering to street people and
okay.
And poor people and, you know, drug addicts and all this kind of stuff. So she thought, well, I'm going to go back to that church another time. That's pretty interesting. And he does rap and she loves rap music. So
okay.
He's doing rap worship and she loves this. And so she goes back another time. The second time she's there, she's sitting there during one of these songs. And she said, all of a sudden, Mom, it was just like everything was downloaded into me. That
Wow.
all truth was downloaded into me and I could see my life,
My
all the
word.
things that were wrong. You know, I could see everything and I could see everything about God and I could just see it all at once. You know, it wasn't all there anymore, but it was there momentarily enough to completely shift her perspective on the world. So I didn't know about any of this. Okay. So she calls me like a week later and she says, can we talk? And I said, sure, you know, anytime. She said, well, I just wanted to ask your forgiveness for all the years that I was away from the
Oh
Lord.
my word. Oh my
And I
word.
said, well, honey, you don't need to ask forgiveness. I have, you know, there's, I have had no negative feelings about you in any way. I've just been praying for you, you know,
yeah.
Believing. And so anyway, she's completely transformed. Well, shortly after that, I see an ad for this Sing conference that's coming up. Like it was in it was Labor Day weekend. So this was almost a year in advance of the conference.
Okay.
And I thought, I'm going to take her to that as a treat. And we're going to just fly out there and go together.
Oh,
so
that's
I bought
amazing.
The tickets way back in, I don't know, November or December last year. And then the two of us flew out there together. And to just
Oh,
have
wow.
that
How
opportunity
special.
to spend time with my daughter, who now loves the Lord the way that I do, you know, was
Oh my word.
amazing.
That must have, yeah, with just heavenly music. Was Shay Lynn there who does hip hop?
Yes.
Okay. Oh,
Yes. Yeah,
wonderful.
they
I'm
had,
so
oh,
glad.
they had a very interesting, diverse set of people. And the thing that my daughter kept saying was, I just can't believe the quality of the music.
Yeah,
It's
it's stunning.
so excellent. Everything about the entire conference was excellent from beginning to
Yeah.
end. It was
Yeah.
all organized in the way to manage your time without wasting any minute of your time and giving you the most possible value that you could have had from the experience. And
Yeah, I've loved my time there. I've been to two Sing conferences now. And we had a church retreat just too close to this year's. Otherwise I would have I would have been, but really lovely. I was just in answering your question, I was gonna kind of give some references that you might know from Sing, just so that you might know a little bit about our church culture. But do you know like City Alight, the
Yes,
group
I
City
love
Alight,
City
were they
Light
there?
music.
Yeah,
Yeah, absolutely.
wonderful. So yeah, those are some of our favorites here, at least some of my favorites here. I have to ask my congregation if it's some of their favorites. That's one of the
Yeah, I
interesting
just
things
love
about.
that they did the song "Ancient of Days," which is a City
Oh
Alight
yeah.
song. I love that song. So, this year the focus of the Sing Conference was that they've been asked by a hymn publishing company to write a new book of hymns. So they've been working on this,
Yeah, I saw that.
and they're about halfway done. And so they wanted to introduce the hymns that they had produced so far.
Yeah.
And so, and then they had some of the City of Light people there, and they had Andrew Peterson
Yeah,
there.
wonderful.
I love his music.
He is a gem.
He didn't do the song that I love though, but he did a lot of other things.
Okay. Is he worthy? Is that the one you're
Yeah,
thinking of?
yeah,
Yeah.
yeah.
Oh,
Oh,
gives me chills every time.
I was just imagining what it would be like to sing that with 6,000 people, you know.
Yeah.
Would have been
Yeah,
something
I
else.
believe they did that when I was there one year at least once. And yeah, that's that one I love every single time. I've led that one a lot, and it still is very special.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a little bit of at least a little bit of flavor about our church culture. But I'm so glad you got to go to Sing Conference. That's very
Well,
special.
so tell me about your thought process when your church went from the typical contemporary music to kind of move more towards this modern hymn kind of music. What was the thought process that you went through and the discussions that the church was going through and everything to make that shift?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I didn't know the worship pastor very well before me when I was hired on. I didn't know him, and so I inherited some culture, but it was a little bit of a blank slate. But it's a Bible church. It's fairly non-denom, and yeah, it could have been at a kind of crossroads anyway, of kind of a which way we're going to go at that time culturally. It did seem like you could turn down the lights and have a light show, or you could kind of pave your own way into something else. And it's hard to say. I hope that it was the Lord's leading and his guidance in kind of not going that way. And we will change the colors of our lights once or twice, two or three times a service, but it's not a light show or anything like that. And so yeah, it was a difficult thing, and it still kind of is something I'm working out in real time, which is why I was so excited to talk to Christian and Drew. I think they have good heads on their shoulders about that conversation. But it seemed like to me that this was something in your conversation with Drew I wanted to actually re-bring up. But you talked about needing it seemed like people needed surprise, was the word you used, to be an element of the music that kind of had to be there. I think you said something like within the first 30 seconds. This is years ago for you, but I watched it this morning, so it's fresh in my mind. But you said something like you need to surprise people in the first 30 seconds, or you lose them, or something like that. I don't know if you remember any of this, but
I think that might have been a quote from somebody.
okay.
That doesn't sound like
Yeah, no,
doesn't sound like
you were
something I would
quoting. No,
make
you
as a
were you
positive.
right, exactly. You were quoting someone as and it was in regards to some new melodies, some things that just it didn't seem like they were like you were able to sing them. That's a huge, that's a huge portion of, even something like the Sing Conference. They're clearly valuing people to be able to sing these songs. That's such an important, but there's something going on where there's a culture, you might even call it progress or something. It has to be new. And it has to be surprising. And if you do that infinitely, you just frankly lose people. There's too much surprise, and not enough order. That's one of my favorite definitions of beauty is a combination of order and surprise. But you have to be careful with both of those things. And I think a lot of too much modern church music has leaned into surprise, and it's almost turned into a gimmick. It's surprise for surprise sake, and there's not enough order, especially. So that's a start, I might say. But what do you think of that definition of beauty?
Well, it's very, very interesting because many things in my mind at one time. One of them is Jordan Peterson's definition of the world is that it's made up of order and chaos. And
Right.
so it's super important that it doesn't become too rigidly ordered and it doesn't become too randomly chaotic, but both are needed, and that's that it's that edge between order and chaos is where all the creativity takes place.
Yeah.
So you're in order and you have the stability of the order, but you should be able to keep that stability, or that at least there is an element of humanity that is able to stay in order and put one foot over into chaos and voluntarily look around there and find something useful and bring it back to revivify the order. That's the best picture.
Yeah.
But there are times when you fall over into the chaos involuntarily, and what do you do then? And part of what you do then is you look around in the darkness for the hidden treasure there, which there is, and then you bring it back with you into the order. Okay, so that's the basic picture. Now, in art, in painting, there are seven elements and eight principles that I adhere to in terms of the way I think about painting. And part of, I talked with Drew and later with Neil deGrade about that. Is that right? Neil deGrade? Yes.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. I'm getting Neil deGrasse Tyson over here.
Yeah. That was how I wanted to finish it as well. But yeah, he's the Orthodox, and he is in the band Dirt Poor Robins, right? Yes, I've only listened a little bit, but
yeah. So I talked with them about this thing about the, but part of the problem with having all of these principles is if you keep them in mind, you can't really work because you get immobilized by it. So, so what you do is you make yourself a little framework that is unity with variety, which is very similar to order with surprise.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
And so that's kind of the same framework. But it also makes me think about the whole Carl Friston active inference engine idea about what life consists of is that even the smallest organic life is always seeking to minimize surprise, because the only way to successfully navigate and stay alive is to minimize the surprise. So you're always predicting what might happen. And then out of that prediction, you test the prediction. And then if there's no surprise, then you can continue to predict and move forward. But if there is surprise, then you have to adjust your prediction and move forward to minimize the surprise. It's sort of a picture of life. I like a picture of life that has a little bit of surprise in it, not just minimizing, but I mean, it's the basic idea.
Right.
So when I sit down to worship the Lord, which it's not just the music, obviously the whole service is a service of worship. And every time you wake up in the morning and every minute you live every day is a service of worship. But when I sit down with my fellow believers to sing, I want somehow to be able to predict where the next note is going to go, at least within a range. At least I know it's going to be one of these five notes and I know how to hit it. But if I'm trying to sing along with somebody and I cannot predict where any note is ever going to go, it's a total like, I'm obviously not supposed to be singing. I'm supposed to be listening to this guy on stage sing.
Yeah. No, I
and
think
then
that's,
it's not
that's
a
so
worship
important.
Service. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You're, and that's where, you know, participation is what you are there to do. If losing participation is a huge deal that we should pay attention to, especially people in my role, worship leaders and worship pastors. If you lose people participating and they become an audience rather than a congregation, that's a bad sign. And so frankly, you can notice it if you do a song, with where I'm standing, you can notice whether people are watching or whether they are singing. A city, a song by City of Light gets by two weeks in a row of singing it, you can see participation happening at scale. And And there's some songs where you 3-4 weeks and there's still no participation. People are not picking up on it. And so that was a lot of, I would say a lot of it for me was paying attention to participation and then letting that guide me. But one of the other things I wanted to mention there too, is that there's a lot of things about church that are surprising, that are kind of inherently surprising or constantly surprising that we should create room for our minds to pay attention to. And if we use that energy to find a melody, we miss the surprise of the text, and especially the surprise of the cross. I mean, the cross is a constant surprise. I find it very difficult to look at the cross truly and say, oh, ho hum, there it is again. If you look at it, it's so surprising what it is. And so if that's front and center, and there's many other things about the gathering of the church that are so beautiful and so surprising, if you create a show, or if you try to use that, again, that energy, that mental capacity to, you know, have a gimmick or some kind of a theatrical moment, some of these things that are already there, that are just God's mm-hmm. placed, you know, the surprise of communion, mm-hmm. the surprise that we are joining with our neighbor that we don't even know. I mean, that's an unbelievable thing in and of itself. And so I think mm-hmm. we don't notice those things as much when we have to give our energy to following along the melody. Mm-hmm. I mean, it has a lot to do with it, with attention. We have limited attention spans, and I, you know, I feel my role is, you know, shepherding that attention, but drawing it towards Christ himself as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And it's a mm-hmm. difficult thing. We have fickle attention spans, mm-hmm. but I do think that's the goal.
Yeah. I mean, when you're talking there, I'm remembering back. So back in the 90s, early 90s, I was leading worship at a fairly big church. I mean, not a mega church, but like 400 or 500 people. And occasionally I would go to an International Worship Institute conference. I don't know if you ever heard of IWI. They used to have conferences in Dallas every year.
Okay.
So maybe I went to these conferences early 2000s, late 90s or early 2000s. And they were fabulous conferences because they had a lot of different tracks that you could go down. You could go and take classes on how to write music, how to be a better worshiper, how to lead worship, many different aspects of it, how to read in the scriptures about what worship is intended to be. I mean, just all of these things. And then they had wonderful plenary sessions with just amazing speakers and great concerts at night and fabulous music. And they were teaching people how to do the flags and the dance and all many different forms of worship. Mm. And people from all over the world came. So you had, you know, people from Africa and South America and Asia. And it was a spectacular event. Great. But the thing that I noticed is in some of these classes, especially the ones on how to lead worship, they were kind of teaching a trajectory, how to start out in a way that would kind of ease people in and then kind of move up the tempo and then bring it back down to a place where you could really get into the worship kind of. And okay. I'm like feeling very uncomfortable with that. I'm not here to manipulate people's emotions, right?
Drew and Christian and I talked about that some. Yeah, the coercion. There's a there's an element. There's an element where you can certainly cross over into coercion. That's about you know, a particular emotive experience that you can chase you can chase that emotive experience, which has to do with that surprise. But yeah, if it's the goal, that clearly cannot be the goal. There has to be more. But sorry, I interrupted you. Go
no,
ahead.
No, I mean, I think what you just said is super important. I mean, the whole point is just that if you're chasing that emotive experience, or if you're chasing that worship feeling, then you're going to lose the capacity to distinguish between real worship and false worship. I mean, I'm imagining that these people that swirl around and dance around a pole or something like what they talked about in the stories about Baal worship, you know, in the Bible. I imagine that they're having feelings. They're having
Oh,
emotions.
certainly.
They're feeling exaltation and probably even like praising
Certainly.
their gods and everything.
Yep.
But that's not the true worship. So how do you distinguish that? I mean, I think the only way you can, I mean, each person in their own personal walk with the Lord and their own reading and prayer and their experiences in life, they're going to be able to discern the presence of the Holy Spirit and how that brings about a sense of praise and worship in your own heart and life. But it gets drowned out with all of this smoke and mirrors and, you know, fabulous music. And so the other thing I was going to say is, to me, there are some songs that are so amazing, where the words are so powerful and the music is so powerful and exalting God, that it almost goes over the edge and becomes, for me, one of those songs is Name Above All Names, Crystal Gayle's song. Are you familiar with that
Okay.
song?
Charity Gayle?
Charity Gayle. Charity
Yes.
Gayle. Yes.
Yes. Yep. Yes, I do know that song.
And anytime I listen to that song, I'm just transported.
Yeah.
But then it becomes like a mind worm and it's in my head all the time. It colonizes me to such an extent that I can't hear any other music.
Oh,
So
interesting.
there's something a little off about that to me. There's something like where, to me, the beautiful thing about the hymns is that, especially some of the ancient old hymns that have survived and that are, the words are so meaningful and powerful and easy to memorize that they just become internalized and you can carry them with you everywhere. And as long as we're careful that they're actually true words and not false words, right? Then they can be very helpful in times of stress or discomfort or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
But some of these other songs that are so powerful, it's almost like anytime I remember it, I can get into that space. And it's almost like I'm using it as a, I don't know. I don't know how to put it into
No,
words.
I know. I very much know what you're saying. I'm not sure I know the exact words either, but there's something where maybe a question I like to ask is just what's doing the leading, and the, certainly the text, like what is doing the pulling, the pulling on your heartstrings. It's not so much that that pulling on your heartstrings is the thing that's wrong itself. The Lord has certainly made us with those heartstrings and he pulls them, but is the music outpacing the text, or the, you know, is it trying to, or is it supporting that? It seems to me, I can notice when the music is submitting to a text.
Interesting.
It seems like it can lift it up, but it knows its place and isn't trying to be something that it's not. It does seem like we have the ability to notice that, where even if a text is good, you can take music and try to, the music gets out of order and tries to outpace it. Like, we're going to really do something better than the text, but then it is inherently wrong because the text must be better than the music. At least with the type of truths that we are singing. It must be better than just a musical experience. It's so much, we're claiming that it's much more than that. And so
well,
I think,
they have to be united, right? They have to be united without one trying to take over from the other.
Yes, but specifically, like I do like the word submitting, that music it does need to know its place in the order of it. And it can, the music can ride a text upward, but it still needs to know its place, I think. And I think we do have the ability, something what you might be describing is you can know when someone is trying to make the music have the attention. It's like, who's running the show here? Is it the music people running the show, or is the Lord and his truth running the show? Mm-hmm. And it's not so simple to know exactly what it is, but your gut, I think your gut is right to have that question there and notice, this does feel coercive, and why is that?
I there's a couple of things that are coming up for me. One of them has to do with a hymn that I've heard in two different versions, where the one version, the music is supporting the text and the other version is trying to take over. And I'll try to sing that for you a little bit. But before I say that, I went to an art show that was at the museum in San Francisco a number of years ago, and it was called The Cult of Beauty. And it was about the Pre-Raphaelite artists, which is back in the 1800s. You've probably seen some of those paintings. They were typically of, you know, maybe Guinevere and the Knights, or maybe it was Ophelia, or John William Waterhouse was one of those artists. There were a number of these artists that were painfully beautiful work. I mean, just so beautiful. And I noticed as I was walking through the show that it was almost as though it was too much beauty.
Yeah, no,
it
I
was
think
too much beauty in a way that made me feel unclean.
Yeah, totally.
I don't know how to explain it, but.
Well, an extreme example would be something like pornography. You know, the human body is beautiful, and was made and was crafted so beautiful by the Lord. But when it's revealed in such a way, it does make you feel, it makes you feel awful when that curtain is pulled back in a wrongful sense. And you can, again, I think you're right. You can notice when that is happening. And it doesn't always have to be pornography, but I do think the arts have that is the way that they get into idolatry by kind of usurping they become the thing, and once that happens, it needs to be godlike, it needs to be too much, mm-hmm. And you can, yeah, I think you really can notice.
Maybe idolatry is the right word there. Yeah, where they were seeking to usurp God's place in the universe with their beauty. So the other thing is this song, the deep, deep love of Jesus, this old hymn, right? Mm-hmm. My voice is a little raspy because I'm just coming out of, maybe it was COVID or something. I've had something anyway, but I'm going to try.
Okay, wonderful.
Oh, the deep, deep love of Jesus, vast, unmeasured, boundless, free. That's the basic melody, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit somber, a little bit mournful,
mm-hmm.
But it really supports the words in a very powerful way. And when you're singing it, because I mean, the love of Jesus is all wound up with sorrow and pain and suffering, and right?
Yeah.
Well, we were in a church at one point back in the early 80s, I went to graduate school to prepare to go as a missionary teaching English as a second language. And there was this campus church that was just so alive and filled with great music. And they were having meetings on Friday nights, and 400 or 500 students would come. And I mean, it was wow. just lively.
Wow.
We found out later it was kind of a cult. Oh. It took a while, though. It was one of these cults that was just off the edge a little bit to where, and because I was a fairly new believer at the time, I became a Christian in 1980. So this would have been 1983. I didn't have my feelers out well enough. So we were in that church probably for half a year before we realized, wait a minute, this is very cult-like. But they had this great music. They would take old hymns and make them new. They would take scriptures and put them to music, and really singable, and everybody's just loving it. But what they did with that song was, oh, the deep, deep love of Jesus, vast, unmeasured, boundless, free, rolling as a mighty ocean in its fullness over me. And at the time I thought, wow, that's great. You know, so singable. But as the years go by, I'm like, that's not right. That's not the right music.
Interesting. Yeah. Oh man, that is such an interesting, we need Drew here. I need my friend Drew here. Cause I know he would have, lots of thoughts on that. The way that melodies participate in the storytelling itself, is such a mystery to me, because while I know exactly what you're saying, I can hear that there's certainly, I might use the word reverence here in your first melody. It just seems more reverent. The other one seems more casual, and yeah, that's one of my, that is one of the biggest questions I have, because here my, in one sense, to kind of play the devil's advocate a little bit, and one reason I do like being in a kind of low church expression, or not incredibly casual here, but some will walk in our space and say, oh, these are casual-ish people, at least compared to other churches. And there's part of me that does really like that. There's someone that might come in that, you know, they feel that they might walk in a space and they will just feel like, how could they possibly, with their sin and, you know, their status in the world, sing to God? And someone gives them one of these more low accessible melodies that they, you know, heard, that is more a part of their culture that they were in this week. But the text is, oh, the deep, deep love of Jesus. And I do very much see the value in that person, Christian, in our conversation, he called it people's heart language. That there's something there where they can, oh, I can speak that language, and that is very compelling to me too. That God would stoop low to us, and he does stoop low. But I do think maturity over time, to kind of flip back on the other side, I do see that a mature place is more to notice that there is melodies that can be more actually reverent, and it is more appropriate to use those as much as I guess possible. And then I guess you employ that you. You use those in wisdom, and that's a difficult part of the process is where those fit, and you need to read your church culture. That's so much of what I feel I'm doing is getting a sense for where we as a people are at in my church, in my time, in this specific context. Then you need to employ that wisdom. between those two poles. But man, that is still one of my biggest questions, because I am nervous about, I've seen certainly many church cultures today going way too far into the casual, and it becomes, I mean, yeah, people have made the critique rightly that it's like, is this a nightclub or a church? You know, I mean, I think that's if you ever are asking that question, you should think, hold on, there's something not right about this. And I'm not saying all those people are cults or anything like that, but we should, those are important questions to ask today about church music, for sure.
Well, I guess the word reverent wasn't the one that had occurred to me with the first melody. It's more
interesting.
I think it would be more like, what is the true biblical meaning? What is the meaning when we talk about joy in the church? Now, some people would say the second melody is much more joyful. But is it joyful or is it happy?
Yeah.
Is it joyful or is it pretty? Is it joyful or is it expressive?
Yeah.
The first melody could sound very mournful, but maybe that's where that joy is. Maybe that deep joy is in the midst of a recognition of, as you said, the surprise of the cross, the radical nature of the cross, and our connection with the cross. And there is a deep joy in that as well. Like I said, I sang the second version of it for years and felt that it had this soaring sense of, you know, joy and recognizing the light and the life that the Lord can bring into our lives, and thinking of the other version as mournful.
Yeah.
But over time, I think I began to shift more towards, what do we really mean when we say joy? And part of it is because I've been in situations where I was in a choir for a while, a fantastic church choir with an absolutely amazing director. But at one point he brought in this song that to me sounded like a nightclub song. It was a nightclub melody put to some beautiful lyrics. And I suppose I was a pompous little twit, but I went to him after we went through that song the first time. And I said, I can't sing this song. I literally cannot sing this song. Not I am opposed to singing this song. There was nothing in me that would allow those notes to come out of my mouth with those words. And, and he totally didn't understand where I was coming from. I mean, I tried my best to explain to him. I just said, I'm going to have to sit this one out.
Oh, interesting.
Or maybe I can mouth the words, but I can't sing this song.
Yeah.
I don't think it's the right thing to do here, because it's not, okay, let me set that aside for a second. The other thing that has really bothered me about worship, because I've been a Christian now for 44 years. So I've seen a lot of different, you know, trails.
Movements, yeah.
And starting in the early 90s, when the Hillsong kind of music came in, when it first came in, it was very exalting of the Lord, very worshipful. And then over time, it and some of the other kinds of contemporary music that came along tended to get into this, oh me, oh my life is difficult and I'm having struggles and I'm so thankful that you're here to help me, which is, you know, I mean, that's valid. But if all of the music is that during a worship service, and there's never anything that turns your eyes back up and says, Lord, you 100%. Are exalted. And because if I get all in about me, then there's no hope. The world is hopeless if it's all about me and my problems. And I noticed that go on for a long time, where if I was in a church for a while where I would just walk away feeling so defeated, like, yeah, it's true. You know, my life is hard and, you know, because there was no victory.
Yeah.
Right. There has to be the victory side.
Yes, 100%. Yeah, I mean, it's difficult even in the Psalms of lament. I mean, you will notice sometimes they will just switch, and it's almost like they turn on a dime. They'll be at the lowest low point, Lord, I am in the pit of pits here, and then it just snap of a fingers, and they're on the mountaintop praising again. And I don't know of one. I wish
Psalm
I should I
73.
should I
Psalm
should
73
look.
is a good example.
Wonderful. Yeah, I
Yeah.
should look up this more, but I don't know of one that has no, it where it's just pure lament. It
There
would
are
be,
some, but then the very next psalm
yeah,
will
they'll organize, yeah, the way
be up
it's
there. And it's
organized,
almost
and
as though those two were one psalm at one time
yeah,
and then they
or
got
were meant to,
split. Yeah.
they're meant to go. They're certainly meant to go together. But no, I think that is, that's exactly right. I mean, one of the quotes that I talk about with my team a lot, that I probably think about this quote once a day, but it's Lewis's quote, aim at heaven and you'll get earth thrown in, aim at earth and you'll get neither. That there's this desire here to aim at those earthly emotions, to try to process those with in and of themselves. There's so many ways that this quote applies to nearly everything. But in this case, I can see it. There must be a point in a worship service where you are aiming at heaven, where your gaze is transfixed all the way up. And there's so many things about our laments, our lives, our sadness that get when those things interact. I mean, so many wonderful things happen, and then all those emotions that you wanted to process, this is the getting earth thrown in part, so many of those things solve themselves in many ways. One of my other verses we use for our team a lot is Psalm 37:4. Delight yourself in the Lord, and He will give you the desires of your heart. It's very much a aim at heaven and get earth thrown in type of a thing. You delight, no matter where you're at. You might have deep longings, the desires that you think there's no satisfaction for this desire, it's too deep or whatever. But it's really quite a radical claim of that verse. Delight yourself in the Lord, and He will give you the desires of your heart. I mean, really, that's how it works. And so I worship in church, I do think it must have that type of ultimate praise and delight in the Lord, very specifically, not about us. But then those the desires that we have, they get thrown in some sense. They do get satisfied, but it must be in that order where we are, where we re it does come from the Lord. It doesn't come from singing. It doesn't come from, if we process it the right way, although that's important. Maybe that's a whole other conversation, but it is so wonderful and never ceases to amaze me how the Lord can satisfy people who are in such dark places in a song of praise. Their eyes are lifted up to the hills, and they realize, oh, that's where my help comes from. And I was just down here trying to figure it out myself. And so that praise where you realize, oh no, I have a God who has these characteristics. He's the Alpha and Omega. And suddenly your problems become contextualized in who God is. And it's not that they're not important, but they get yeah, contextualized into who He is. And so often that's the way that things are solved, when you realize, yeah, who God is. That's such a wonderful thing to me. I'm so, as a worship pastor, that's one of my favorite things I get to see, when I know someone's story and they're struggling so deeply, and they sing a song of praise, and I can just tell there's a moment of pure satisfaction between them and the Lord. I hope I never tire of that miracle, you know?
There's an old song that made the rounds back in maybe the 80s. Praise the Lord, for our God inhabits praise. And the chains that seem to bind you will fall powerless behind you when you praise the Lord. Because our God inhabits praise. So when we praise, we're right there in his habitation with him.
Yeah.
And that's what really transforms the mind. And, you know, you need a transformed mind in order to see the world aright, because there is a reality. There is a there. But if our eyes are clouded, then we're not seeing the truth, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. That's wonderful.
Well, maybe that's a good place to stop. Unless you had, did you have some questions for me? I mean, I've talked a lot already, but.
Yeah, you know, so there was one little serendipitous thing. This is a little bit of a tangent. We don't have to take too long on this, but I've had this conception, and I didn't even know if we could make it here, but there's little serendipitous moment. When I was listening to your conversation with Drew today, you said something that was almost exactly what I was going to bring it up. So I'm going to just take a little bit of a risk, because I've been trying to explain the ways that our postmodern world and our modern world lies to us. And I had this conception that I just want to know what you think of this and how this hits you, because you described something so close to this. You talked about a telescope and looking up at the stars and the importance of seeing it from our own point of view and our own bodies. Anyway, so let me just, I want to see how this hits you. So I've been conceiving of this as looking up at the stars. So imagine you and a friend, you're looking up at the stars and you're trying to make meaning. You know, okay, here's just a quick aside. Why did you name your channel The Meaning Code? There's kind of obvious things here, but yeah.
Well, two reasons. One would be, I got interested in this stuff because of reading The Maps of Meaning by Jordan Peterson.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
But the other side of it is that the way that I paint is to start with chaos, and then I see the patterns in the chaos.
Yeah.
And then I work towards meaning. I work towards meaning out of chaos. And because I think, I don't know if you had a chance to listen to the talk that I did at the Northwest Estuary Conference.
I haven't yet.
But in that, I laid out my picture of, I think, pretty much how the universe works, how creation works, how our little prediction engine as we move forward in life works, how art works, how writing, music, they all work the same way, which is there's an idea, and then you have to articulate that idea out into steps.
Yeah.
But in painting, you have the idea, and then you have to take your materials and your tools and your substrate and the idea, and stroke by stroke, you have to build that back up to where it becomes the idea again. Only now the idea is substantiated in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The way that that happens is very mysteriously tied to a set of principles that govern the entire process.
Mm-hmm.
If you're open to allowing those principles to govern your process, then what is achieved is beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And those principles are unity, harmony, contrast, repetition, dominance, variation, gradation, and balance. And there's probably some other principles, but all of the choices that you make are somewhere along a sliding scale of every one of those principles, so that every choice lands somewhere in a particular place for a particular purpose.
Yeah.
That choice may get covered over later on, but before it gets covered up, it informs the next choice. So every single thing you do has meaning, and you're always using that meaning to frame the next choice as you move forward.
Yeah.
That's sort of a
shorthand. I'm very much asking the right person this question. So back to the stars. So mm-hmm. I'm so with especially deconstruction and nihilism, you might call it, meaninglessness, and especially I'm concerned with lack of shared meaning, and I think that's the context that this came up with you and Drew. But so I'm imagining two friends looking up at the stars, and they have the same, their eyes work the same way. And so, and the stars are in place in the, with the levels of, different hierarchies of brightness that are fixed. And so they look up at the stars and, oh, they're, can you see the Big Dipper? And the shared meaning is, yes, I can see the Big Dipper. It's this bright star and this bright star and down the way. And so then, look at, this is, that hunter, Orion, I don't even know if I'm saying that right, but look, we were telling that story the other day, and we have this shared myth that we're talking about. And so, that's his belt up there. Mm-hmm. Do you see that? And so then there's this, that's so much of, that of shared meaning is two people in their bodies without a telescope looking at God's world and seeing it together as it is with the given hierarchies. That's a really important part of this, is there are stars that are objectively brighter than other ones from our point of view. Mm-hmm. My conception of like our problem of modernity and postmodernity is we've been given now this tool of a telescope to create if I'm doing a connect the dots, I now have an infinite set of connect the dots.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I have a telescope, and that's not the Big Dipper. Don't you see? I just connect the lines differently, and now it's this totally other image. Don't you see my image? Mm-hmm. I have this telescope. Oh, you have your telescope. Mm-hmm. You're still stuck in the past. This is why I've been loving reading C.S. Lewis, because he's stuck in the past. And he says, he's like, I'm not going to move. Mm-hmm. Don't discard the image that I see in the stars. And so, I really just wonder, am I on to something with that conception? I've been trying to.
Oh yeah. I mean, that's a perfect conception.
Use something like that to talk about why we don't have shared meaning anymore. We're kind of always using the telescope, or we now know where it's like, oh, there's not just those stars. There's a billion stars. And so it's all thrown. I just wondered how that hit you specifically. And if you have anything I should add or take away when I kind of
am. Well, I mean, I can give you examples that you can add to that. One example would be, and I mean, this has probably been overused, but back in the day when I used to work in an office, and people go to the water cooler and they're like, oh, did you see whatever, I Love Lucy last night?
Right.
Oh, yeah, that scene with the candy thing was so funny,
Yep.
Well, now somebody can say, did you see that Lucy thing with the candy thing? It was on TikTok. Well, no, I saw 8 million other TikToks. Right. I didn't see that TikTok,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's one example. We don't have a shared tradition anymore. So there's that. Then there's the whole issue of too much information. We have so much information. that we're on information overload all the time, and it's hard to pick out the patterns. We can't see each other's patterns. So yes, postmodernism is true. There is an infinity of information out there. But I don't know if you've run into John Verbeke's work.
A little bit. I've mostly listened to his conversations with Jonathan Peugeot, who I think just because he, you know, he does so much work with liturgy, I'm a little less knowledgeable about psychology and and so, but I've loved been really interested in what I do think I've heard him say something about that, you know, relating to my little story or example, but that those hierarchies of where the stars are actually placed, the ability to notice that there is a hierarchy and a separation between is part of what would be a significant part of what to pay attention to in terms of meeting. What is he called?
Well, the reason I brought it up is this whole idea of salience.
Okay.
So salience is the thing that rises up in your own value hierarchy when you look at something. What is salient to me at the moment is the thing that is based on maybe what I'm thinking about right now, or you know, where my own values are, might be different from somebody else's. So that's one of the things he talks about. But Jordan Peterson is focusing on this idea that for all of us, the only way that we can move forward in this sea of infinite potential, all of this information, is to fix our gaze on that which is the highest. When you do that, then the things that you need to move towards that goal will come into your salience hierarchy, and you will see what you need to make the next move. So I think it would be good. Have you watched Jordan Peterson's biblical series?
Some of it, back in, I guess now 5 years ago, I probably listened to 10 hours of lectures of that. I haven't gone through, all of it, but when my friends kind of, I had a few friends first telling me about him, that's what was out there.
If you've been reading some C.S. Lewis and you've been pondering all this stuff about worship and everything, if you went back now and watched it, I think it would be in your salience hierarchy a lot more. It really, I mean, for me, when I watched that series, it was like, well, yeah, somehow just using, this was what amazed me, just using his background in psychology and philosophy and history and all the people that he's quoting in this book, just using that and not being a believer, he has stumbled on this same set of truths that God has taught me over my entire Christian life.
Yeah, I thought that was
okay. So that means there's a truth that's there,
right?
That's visible, that can be seen if you pursue it hard enough. And to me, that was, but the thing that he does is he puts it into language that makes it expressible to people and makes it accessible. And that was the thing that really fascinated me. So that was why I wanted to pursue more. So I've gone down the road mostly of science, trying to see why science and faith got off the rails with each other. And that's most of what I do on the Meaning Code.
I hope you can fully answer that question for us one day. That would help quite a bit. But yeah, I very much I've watched Angels in Scientific Terms. That was one with Jonathan and John Verveke. That did you watch that one by chance?
Because I use most of my time to watch science videos, I don't have time to watch a lot of other stuff. But I do know that Peterson's biblical series was very helpful to me to find the language. And also the fact that he talks about the Bible not being what happened, but what always happens.
Yeah.
It's what always happens. It's truer than true. And that changed the way that I read the Bible, because now when I read the Bible and I look at it, I always knew that there was more to every verse than you could ever conceive. But now I look at that verse and I look at every word in it, and there's more in every word in that verse than you can conceive. The meaning just goes down, 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 down.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
so it has really enriched my study of the word. But hey, I'm on a hard stop here. I got to go.
All right.
Maybe we can talk again sometime.
Thank you so much, Karen. Deeply appreciated it. And you have so many insights. So just thank you so much.
Send me your next playlist. I'd love to know what you're doing Sunday.
Okay. Sounds good.
Okay. Have a great day.
God bless you.
Yeah. Bye-bye.